Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Sustainable Finance Podcast. My name is Paul Ellis, and I'm your host for these programs about developments in this fast-growing industry. Allison Binns is the founder and principal of Peregrine Strategy, which provides sustainable solutions for institutional investors, like ESG market analysis and education, regulatory risk management, and investment process design. She is also a senior advisor at Danu Venture Group, which provides early-stage investment access to technology companies focused on national security, new infrastructure, and their enabling industries. Allison says her background as an immigrant kid has shaped the way she approaches investments and sustainability in general. Hello, Allison, and welcome to the Sustainable Finance Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Paul.
Yes, it's a real treat. We're finally getting around to recording here, and we're going to start right out of the gate here with what are the trends or innovations that excite you the most about the future of sustainable finance, and what areas still need the most progress?
That is a big question to start with, but always happy to tackle a challenge. The future of sustainable finance, one, is very bright indeed, I think. What we're seeing now is a massive techno-industrialist shift in the global economy. So looking at transition era technologies like battery storage, electric vehicles, wind, solar, these are really the technology and industrial areas that I think are going to shape the global economy for decades to come. And it's a huge opportunity. Potentially, $4 trillion. We think it's going to be about 30 to 40% of the total economic opportunity around the world. That's a big challenge, though, because we're not currently set up to prioritize those technology and industrial areas. And so you're going to see a huge shift towards these more sustainable technologies. The U.S. in particular is not well prepared, I would say, compared to the EU and China to take advantage of these sort of secular global trends towards decarbonization technologies. And that's something that we need to really catch up and make more progress from a competitiveness perspective. So if you think about competitiveness as scale and innovation, so the ability to create these new technologies or create progress in these new technology areas, and then scale just the ability to produce them and make them commercial. We're really lagging behind China, which leads on almost every sort of transition area technology, and the EU, which has had a much more comprehensive and focused effort to transition the European Union economy towards decarbonization, towards 2050, et cetera. So there's a great white paper from BCG on this sort of techno-industrial shift that shows these transition era technology areas and how the U.S. is currently positioned to sort of capture economic value here. And it really is going to be a challenge for the U.S. to keep up with this shift if we don't have economic and regulatory tailwinds, making it commercially attractive to pursue these technology areas in the short term. We still, the top three for export areas from the U.S. are still very much tied to hydrocarbons. And I think creating the space for businesses to look at shifting towards more electrification, more diversity in energy sources is going to take a real concerted effort at the highest levels of sort of government and business.
Okay. But some people, Allison, are claiming that ESG and sustainability are dead. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's just not true. It's not true. Yeah. I need a hard pass on that.
I'm glad you're laughing.
I'm laughing because it's just so farcical. Before sustainability had a name, before ESG was an acronym, and people love to come for acronyms, you can't have three-letter acronyms anymore. We just need to stop doing that. It was just good business. right? Good managers knew that investing in human capital would directly correlate to returns. Good managers knew that protecting the environment and not being subject to regulatory penalties was just good management, right? Good investors knew that there are a lot of things standing between them and a discounted cash flow model, right? Namely, you know, thousands of employees. You know, and I think this idea that somehow sustainability is going to go away is insane. Here's what I am a little bit excited about. People have felt the need to label things as, oh, this is an ESG fund, or this is sustainable, full stop. And the world is just so much more complex than that kind of black and white thinking. And so I do think we can abandon some of the labeling, some of the marketing, some of the greenwashing, and actually get the hard work done. You know, a lot of asset managers that are sort of taking a step back from ESG, their idea of taking a step back from ESG is just calling it something different. Like, you're just using the technical term now. So you're not saying ESG and sustainability, you're saying material, non-financial factors. Well, that's what we should have just been calling it the whole time anyway, because that's what they are. They're material, non-financial factors. Material being a very important word for American corporate governance. Material means, under US law, information that a reasonable investor would want to know before making an investment decision. And a reasonable investor is going to want to know if there's a lot of turnover in doctors at a hospital, because that's going to affect cash flow, because when the doctors go, the patients go, right? A reasonable investor is going to want to know if in an environment with increasing regulation for energy efficiency, if, you know, a building that they're going to buy is well suited to being resilient to those regulations so that they don't that we're not subject to penalties, right? The reasonable investor is very pragmatic. And, you know, just because a factor is non-financial doesn't mean that it doesn't have financial impact. It just means that it's not going to be, you know, a line item on an income statement or a balance sheet. But these are things that affect the way companies make money and affect long-term success. And so I think we really do have an opportunity, those of us in the sustainable investing community, to prove out what we've been talking about for years, which is this is a better way of investing. You're capturing a broader spectrum of risk. You're managing a broader spectrum of risk. You're being a more responsible investor by taking in these non-financial factors into account and not just looking at a very efficient cash flow model and sort of pretending that nothing else matters, right?
That's a very good description, in my experience of 25 years, of what is actually happening within the economy and companies when they move in a more sustainable direction over time. How do you see the future of ESG and sustainability issues evolving given the current social and political and regulatory environment in the U.S. and the EU? Let's start there.
Yeah, no, I think it's really interesting. Again, I think we're going to stop being as loud about this is sustainable, because from this sort of socio-political perspective, that's fallen out of favor a little bit. But I think we're now sort of under the gun to actually make the business case. We've been saying forever that this is a better way to invest. Okay, we'll prove it out. You know, start proving out how having a more sustainable approach to business does matter for the bottom line. How it tying non-financial factors to lines on financial statements is very important. Understanding how risk factors that are material need to go into a corporate 10K is very important. I think because there are these connections between performance and sustainability factors, I don't think you're going to see it go away. We're just going to talk about it differently. I think what's interesting for the U.S. is that we're now going into a sort of deregulatory cycle in the current administration. And so making the business case is going to be so much more important because, you know, this can no longer be a marketing exercise. And I actually think that our ability to entrench sustainable practices are much higher now than they were before, because things are going to have to be commercial. I think you're going to see a sort of flight to the most viable, the most scalable, the most workable options from an energy transition perspective, new energy technologies, et cetera. People are going to have to justify exactly what they're doing and why they're doing it more explicitly than just saying, oh, this is an ESG fund, let's invest here. From the European perspective, and frankly, the rest of the global economy perspective, I think it's a completely different story, because there are structural trends, secular trends outside of the U.S. towards decarbonization, towards having policy consistency on incentivizing this move towards the energy transition, towards probably not net zero, which may or may not be achievable, but in that direction, right? Like really reorienting things in that direction. And it's not just the EU. The EU obviously is doing the most, maybe even too much from a regulatory perspective, to transition both, you know, corporates and financials in the direction of investing more sustainably. But you've also seen China taking on more sustainability policies in the five-year plan, which are sort of aligned more with the European approach to regulations. And I think that that is really important. I was actually looking at a Bank of China sustainability report that was done, and I was very surprised to see that all of the reporting was aligned very specifically with, you know, the SFDR and the EU taxonomy sort of reporting requirements, down to things like average gender pay gap, which I was surprised to see, you know, large Chinese financial reporting against. And I think looking at that sort of convergence of here are the sort of metrics that matter outside of the United States, I think is really important, because the rest of the world is sort of moving in one direction. And I think we are lagging behind a little bit.
Okay. You've worked in a number of roles across the corporate and financial ecosystem, from a global multinational to a sell-side investment bank to an alternative asset manager, and now you're in venture capital. I'm very excited about what's going on in venture capital and private equity these days. What role do you see venture capital funds playing in the future of sustainability?
So I think this is really exciting, and I've had a lot of thoughts on venture capital when I was not working in venture capital. It's easy to sort of, lob grenades over the fence line when you're not actually doing the work, but here I am, right? So I think venture capital plays a significant role in sustainability that cannot be overestimated how much impact they can have. Because what you've seen over the last two decades or so of working on sustainability issues is we've been retrofitting existing companies for more sustainable thinking, right? We've been taking companies and sort of putting sustainability back into the way they're thinking about their business for the long term. And that's really inefficient, right? Coming from a fixed income background, there's nothing that fixed income investors hate more than looking at, another expense line. Right? It's like, so there's less cash flow because you're siphoning money into these activities that often are hard to connect to short-term returns, right? What venture capital can do is just build these businesses with sustainability built in at the beginning instead of having to retrofit them. And I think, it's a huge opportunity. If you think about, there's a company called Allbirds, which the founder is a dear friend. And so I'm probably biased, for the record. But what Allbirds did, I just conflict of interest. Let's be.
Of course.
Good governance.
Yes.
But what Allbirds did was build sustainability into their entire business model at the very beginning as the company was being built. So thinking about sustainability in design, thinking about sustainability in sourcing materials, thinking about sustainability in the whole life cycle of a shoe. It's a shoe and apparel company, right? And so they can't really strip out how much are you spending on sustainability because it's just a part of the way each part of their business works, right? And so that's what I mean by building sustainable thinking, design thinking into companies when they're early stage rather than when they're late stage and you have to go through a bunch of organizational change, which is expensive and hard to do. But if you build those principles of sustainable thinking into a business when it's young, there's a concept in organizational sociology called organizational imprinting. And it's essentially like the founders and the, you know, sort of microculture at the very beginning of a company have outsized effects on how the company turns out to be as it continues growing. And I think we need more sustainability in the organizational imprinting phase of companies, in early stage companies, so that as they continue to grow, it's just a part of the way they do business. And it doesn't have to be a carve out, and there doesn't need to be a sustainability team, and there doesn't need to be necessarily a chief sustainability officer, because it's built into the way everybody thinks across the business units and not just in policy or marketing, et cetera. So I think, you know, I think venture capital is a challenge because when these companies are very small, people don't necessarily think about consciously crafting corporate culture. A lot of alliteration, but the conscious crafting of corporate culture is very important, I think, to growing a sustainable business. But yeah, if you ever talk to startup founders, they're drowning all the time, right? It is just the one thing that they are typically concerned about is getting to a place of being revenue positive and figuring out how to scale, oftentimes sacrificing some of the resilience factors like organizational culture, like sustainable thinking, et cetera, along the way. I do think we've had a couple big examples of venture unicorns trying to come into the capital markets and the capital markets being like, what is this? You don't have an HR department. Like, you don't, there are a bunch of sort of governance issues here that are sort of no longer acceptable in the capital markets. So I think venture as an industry is trying to be more strategic about it. But it takes a lot of work, and it takes intention. It takes a lot of intention. And sort of separately, that's more from every company can be more sustainable, but from a sort of sustainability pure play perspective, I think there's so many companies now that are focused on sustainable solutions, everything from packaging to new energy technologies. I think the field is really interesting and really robust. I would say some of the challenges are pretty large. There's not a lot of capital for project finance, which I think some of the most interesting infrastructure-focused sustainability companies need right now. And there's a lot of R&D that needs to happen, which has been really challenging to get funding for. It's also a miserable fundraising environment right now. So everybody is struggling, but the ideas are there. And like I said before, because we're in a challenging environment where you can't really talk about, you know, ESG and sustainability in the same way, I do think that the sort of best ideas in VC are going to coalesce around the best investors in VC are going to coalesce around the best ideas that are commercially viable and scalable, and hopefully we'll work with some of the bigger partners in the market in order to achieve scale. So keeping an eye on the Amazon venture arm and the Google venture arm to see what they're thinking about, because the scale is so important. It's so important. And it is one of the challenges, I think, for sustainable technologies is that you have to have sort of sponsorship by a larger company that can scale, that understands the regulatory legal process, is licensed to operate in multiple states and countries and those kinds of things. It's one of the reasons, and I'm going to stop talking in a second, but it's one of the reasons that I still am very big on the role of oil companies and large global multinationals in the energy transition and in sustainable finance and technology, because they have those skills that small companies are never going to be able to get, right? I mean, and they've created this global architecture over, for an Exxon of 130 years or something, where, yeah, they have a license to operate in every country on earth, except probably North Korea, right? And they can work across regulatory boundaries, legal challenges, language. I mean, all of these things that make scaling technologies difficult, they have the infrastructure for. And so I think, you hope that when the right zero carbon energy technology is invented or discovered, that they get a sponsor that is a big company that can help to sort of push it across all of the different systemic boundaries that we have.
Okay, well, listen, we both know some organizations who are really supporting that initiative, that kind of initiative, organizations like Novata, for example, where they're really supporting the growth of startup companies, at least in terms of the reporting and metrics that they're tracking and all of those kinds of things, and they're getting them to think ahead, which is, I think, really the key to what you've been describing, is planning ahead and having not only the resources to do that, but the opportunity to do it on a regular basis.
Yeah,
now, go ahead.
Oh no, I was going to say, I'm glad you brought up Novata, because I think, it ties into this sort of venture capital perspective, because so Novata is an ESG platform that is focused on collecting ESG data in private markets. And I think it speaks to a larger trend. Companies are staying private longer. Entering the capital markets is no longer necessarily the sort of holy grail for companies anymore. And so, but in, private companies have no responsibility to report on sustainability necessarily. And so it's essentially been a black box, but it's also sort of the engine, the middle market and the lower middle market companies are the engine of the American economy. And so, but we've had no visibility into sustainability practices, benchmarking, none of that. And so what Novata is trying to do is, collect data, help companies collect their own data, report on their own data, but also by giving them sort of broader private market benchmarks, the ability to understand what they're doing well and what they're doing poorly. And I think it's a huge opportunity. It is completely unknown. Novata is going to have a database of ESG data that could completely reshape the private markets, because right now, for public markets, you very much have, companies have coalesced around, here's what good governance looks like. And you've seen companies converge onto like a pretty sort of normal good governance model. And the companies that are sort of anomalies, that are doing things differently. And some of them trade at a discount because they have, there's a pricing mechanism in the public markets. And so when you do have regulatory issues, when you have class action lawsuits, when you have, there is a function to price that. We don't have that in the private markets because we don't know. We don't know what good looks like. We don't know what average looks like. And so we're not able to price sustainability issues into the value of private companies. And we are now going to be able to do that. And that will revolutionize the way we think about valuation and the way private companies think about sustainability, because it will be valuable. When you think about the private equity firms and these sort of alternative asset managers that are providing the debt and equity for private companies, they care about this, and that sort of rolls downhill. If a company is able to collect and report on their data, they're going to be more valuable for the next private equity sponsor that they have, or their ability to raise debt capital, et cetera. And so I think it's going to be truly transformative for the private market.
Okay. Well, we're going to end our conversation today with a brief description from you of your background as an immigrant kid and the influence that had on the way that you approach investing and sustainability. So go for it.
Yeah. So I'm an immigrant kid. I'm very much an American, but it's always different when your parents come from somewhere else. And so my parents are from Jamaica. We come from a very rural community in Jamaica. So growing up, when we would go back to visit family, it was very different from my life in suburban New Jersey. In the 90s, parts of the community had no electricity or running water. We still used sort of kerosene lamps. It was a really interesting juxtaposition, frankly, to come from a nice sort of suburban neighborhood in New Jersey to sort of see a completely different way of living. And so I think it's definitely informed the way I think about sustainability, and it's informed some of the challenges that sustainability has, right? We think of, the way we think of sort of labor rights in the US versus in developing countries is very differently. A lot of times American companies are like, oh, if we can't work to this standard, then we'll just go somewhere else, right? But when it's your family and you know how precious any kind of job is, right? It just is viscerally very different to think about. And so I would rather companies stay engaged to improve working conditions than to sort of just take their things and leave. I also think about the environment that we're in and the challenges that we face and this existential crisis of the energy transition. I promise you that, my family was not a key driver of climate change and emissions, right? We were very much, even when I was a child, going places on donkeys, not on cars, not a huge sort of industrial footprint. And so when you think about the burden of who should be paying for climate change, when you think about the difference between northern and southern hemispheres, when you think about the difference between the developed economies and developing economies, often I don't think we're sharing the burden equitably, not equally, equitably, given where the roots of the current climate crisis. And it's particularly challenging for energy because, the developed world developed based on extraordinarily cheap oil and gas, right? That's where the industrial revolution's engine comes from. And now that climate is a problem, it's hard to say, well, we did this, and we've created this problem, but we've also grown our economies. You, Southern Hemisphere countries, should not have that same opportunity. I think that is a very challenging conversation to have. There are no easy answers there. I think, the U.S. is going to have a hard enough time decarbonizing its own economy. And I think it's increasingly less popular to think about aid to other countries that are also going to face those challenges. In some ways, I hope that the energy transition follows a sort of leapfrog model. And I'll tell you what I mean. I mean, when I was little going back and forth to Jamaica, I remember the scheduling of phone calls, right, was challenging. And my mother would send a letter 3 months in advance. It would get there at some point, telling our family members to be waiting for a call, which means they have to walk a few miles to the local corner store. And then my mother would call the corner store and then you'd be able to have a sort of voice conversation. And so that was how it was for most of my life. And then at one point, my uncle called on a cell phone while skinning a goat in his backyard. And it was they just skip the landlines, right? You skip the landlines.
You skip right to the newer technologies, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so you hope that the energy transition shows that kind of leapfrogging, where it's like, okay, you don't have to put up a bunch of telephone poles. You can just have digital infrastructure instead. So from an energy transition perspective, I hope that there are cheaper and commercially scalable forms of, you know, lower carbon technologies that can still be a solid engine of economic growth without having to rely on oil and gas, which is, of course, the driver of the last 100 years of economic progress.
Allison, it's a fascinating story. I'm really glad that we took the time to have you describe your past from this perspective. Right now, what I want to know is, where online can Sustainable Finance Podcast followers go to learn more about Peregrine Strategy, LLC, and Danu Venture Group, and how can they get in touch with you with questions about the topics that we've discussed in today's episode?
Well, you can always find me on LinkedIn. You can also visit my website, which is www.peregrinestrategy.com. The venture capital group that I advise is Danu Venture Group, which is danuvg.com. And I also am an advisor to two ESG startups, Novata, who we talked through a little bit previously, and Persephone AI, which does carbon accounting. And so you can find me in any of those places. And I look forward to engaging with followers of your podcast.
Great. Well, thanks again very much to our guest today, Allison Binns, and followers of the Sustainable Finance Podcast can join me again next week for another episode. I'm Paul Ellis, your host, and this is the Sustainable Finance Podcast.